Welcome. You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
He is the one who used the phrase that this austerity campaign that has been imposed on Greece is fiscal waterboarding. That's what he called it. And he is now the finance minister of the new government. He is the worst nightmare for the neoliberals that are running the European Union. This is exactly the person they did not want to have to negotiate with, because he is not going to just roll over.
That's the voice of economist, author, and educator Robin Hanel. On this week's show, we speak to Robin about the results of the radical left winning the elections in Greece and what it means for the European Union. So stay tuned.
We're live with Dr. Robin Hanel. We're very privileged to have you on our program. Thank you so much for joining us today. Dr. Robin Hanel is an economist. He's an author. He's a prolific teacher. And we're very happy to have him on our program. Thank you again for being with us today.
It's great to be on with you again, Sylvia.
When we think about the recent elections in Greece, there was this idea that they were the underdog, that the chances of Greece electing a party that would go against austerity was, well, not just rare, but very slim chance. And now we are faced with the results of a landslide win. What does this signify for the rest of Europe?
This really is a momentous event, and people should take note. In many different ways. One of the interesting things is that Syriza is actually a coalition of radical political grouplets. And if you go back just 7 or 8 years ago, this coalition was incredibly unlikely. These were groups that had been sort of fighting and feuding with one another. They had very, very small numbers. They had a very difficult time sort of agreeing to form an electoral alliance so that they could run a slate of candidates. And as, you know, as recently as 5 or 6 years ago, Syriza was polling 1, 2, 3%. They weren't polling enough that in the Greek electoral system, you have to get 3% of the vote to get any members in parliament, and they weren't even getting members in parliament. About 2 years ago, they had expanded their share of the vote to an extent where they came within an eyelash of winning the general election 2 years ago. And now, just this, you know, just a week ago, they did win and had an overwhelming electoral victory. So one of the things that's just, you know, very amazing and very heartening is how rapidly you know, a group of rather fractured leftists can grow to, you know, to win the support, you know, and become the majority party. And they literally replaced the center-right and the center-left political parties in Greece had dominated, you know, the Greek electoral scene for, you know, ever since World War II. And PASOK and New Democracy had seen their share of the electoral votes shrink from a combined 80%. Down to, you know, under 30%. And here we have this very new, you know, radical leftist political party growing to government. What's the reason? Well, the reason is that the economic policies of the European Union that were pushed onto Greece and that were accepted by and administered by first the center-right political party and then the center-left Social Democratic PASOK party were absolutely disastrous, that they created a human disaster. Greece has been in a depression, 25% unemployment, 25% drop in GDP, massive increase in poverty, massive increase in a real human health disaster. That's what the austerity policies that the European Union forced on Greece in exchange for loans to prevent default on Greek sovereign government debt. That's what they did to Greek society, and all the traditional parties were going along with this, and Syriza they campaigned against the austerity. They said this is a terrible policy. We will not go along with it. It's even counterproductive in its own terms, that the indebtedness of the government as a percentage of GDP is actually increasing as a result of these policies, because it's driving production and income down so fast that when they cut spending on social welfare programs, it drives production and income down so fast that the taxes they can collect go down even further. In every term, it was a disaster, and there was one political group that was campaigning vehemently opposed to this, saying, we will not go along with this. We are going to say no. We are not going to negotiate any more deals like this. And all the other political parties were going along with it, and people came to their senses and realized that Syriza was their only hope.
Listening to you, I think not only does this teach us that When we come together, when people finally put the dots together, we realize that there are multiple ways of organizing our economy. And a lot of the times we hear the word GDP, and it sounds like something really important, but people don't understand that it just means a portion of the economy is compared to the amount of debt. How would you define then the benefit of having, say, a socialized healthcare program like the one we have in Canada, or a funded education system, contribute to that idea of promoting development or the enlargement, enrichment of that economy portion that they keep referring to as being so essential to our well-doing, but at the same time, austerity seems to be doing the opposite of it?
One issue is development models. I mean, what do we want our economies to do? What kinds of goods and services are more important? And there we've had this contrast between neoliberal capitalist development, which has defunded and withdrawn investment from social services, from education, from healthcare, and basically has steered investment in the direction of asset bubbles, real estate asset bubbles, stock market asset bubbles, and steered investment in Canada in the direction of, raping the environment, raw material extraction, including tar sands, coal, and things that are destroying the environment and the climate. That's one development model, and that's quite different from one that emphasizes production for basically collective social needs and security. And Syriza clearly stands, as a left political coalition, it clearly stands for, a complete reordering of investment priorities and social priorities. But it also, in a much more graphic sense, has stood up and said, we won't go along with policies that are extremely counterproductive in every conceivable sense. But when we in Canada, when leftists in Canada and when leftists in the United States, when we think of ourselves, one of the things we're very painfully aware of is that we are small. We don't have a lot of influence with large parts of the population. We tend to squabble and argue with one another. The less powerful you are, the more time you spend in squabbling and arguing with one another. And I know people from Syriza. I was there 5 years ago. And I listened to them talk about themselves back then, and they described themselves very much in those terms. It's not like they started out any differently than we did. But what is amazing is how you can grow in influence with an increasingly large segment of the population when you simply say things that make sense. When people are being hammered and you say, this is wrong, this is unnecessary, elect us because we won't do it, you can really get someplace, and you can get someplace very quickly. And that's now happened also in Spain. The difference between Spain and Greece really was that there was plenty of opposition in both places to the policies. The policies were almost as disastrous in Spain as they were in Greece. Youth unemployment in both countries, it's up over 50%. This means that anybody that's coming out of school who's a young 20-year-old, it means that they have to emigrate to find a job. That's happened in Ireland also. Well, nobody wants to do that. Their young people simply have to leave the country because there are no jobs. So there were plenty of youth demonstrations and opposition. We had the Indignados and the uprising of the Indignados and the campouts in the square. We had a whole revival of interest in sort of libertarian socialist ideas and non-capitalist ways of going about organizing, you know, economic activity. All of that was in Spain, just as it was in Greece. The one ingredient that came together earlier in Greece was an electoral coalition. But now we see that in the last 12 months in Spain, this party called Podemos, which, again, is a coalition of people who have come to their senses and figured out some way to communicate with the population at large that they are opposed to austerity and they won't go along with it. I mean, we're going to see an election in Spain later this year. And the leader of Podemos, Iglesias, he was standing on the platform, you know, at the last rally that Syriza had before the election on Sunday. And they were basically holding their hands up together and saying, it's not just Greece. You know, this is going on in Spain, too. And we need to turn Europe around. We can't let Europe continue to do this to the southern economies in Europe. So, and that's part of the reason that what will happen in Greece now is so important. That if Syriza can force the European Union to basically change the policies that they are imposing on the southern European economies, if they can do that, then there's a chance that the European Union will survive and perhaps evolve in a more human and social direction with a different idea about what economics should be about. If instead what happens is that the European Union punishes the Greek government, the new Greek government, cuts them off, refuses to negotiate any sort of the necessary forgiveness of debt that's necessary. If that's what happens, then I believe Greece will have to leave the Eurozone. And I think that if Podemos comes to power later this year, or if some similar parties or groups of parties come to power in Portugal, Italy, or Ireland over the next few years, what they will discover is that they have to leave the Eurozone. We're going to see a battle for what kind of Europe it's going to be between the neoliberal version that's been put together, that is basically being controlled by Germany, by the conservative parties in Germany. We're going to see a battle for the soul and the political future of Europe coming ahead.
I am with Dr. Robin Hanel. He is the author of many books. Two of my favorite, though, are The ABCs of Political Economy and your latest one, Of the People, For the People, Participatory Economics. And I wonder if you can talk a little bit then about this idea that, you know, the Eurozone, this economic formation needs to be protected at all costs. You know, there seems to be all this pressure on Greece that if they do this, they're going to be somehow dismantling this economic tool. And I wonder if you could maybe talk a little bit about how the market really is assembled, because we've been led to believe that the market is, you know, has this invisible hand and automatically adjust, and that all these policies are really in the benefit of everybody. And that's not the experience we have had in the past 10 years of, you know, economic austerity and imposed austerity as a result of the economic collapse.
I think two things are going on. Neoliberalism in Europe in particular is disserving and immiserating more people, a higher percentage of the population than elsewhere. So the neoliberal version of capitalism is increasingly coming under question. That's what Syriza is saying no to. That's what Podemos is saying no to. I also think that the younger generation, the fall of the wall and the whole idea that, you know, there is no alternative to capitalism, that certainly, you know, that view became increasingly dominant, you know, in the aftermath of, the fall of the Berlin Wall in the early 1990s. In Europe, this crisis of the only version of capitalism they have right now has also led a young generation to increasingly question whether or not what I just call the economics of competition and greed is the right way to organize things. Because a lot of what's happening outside of the political parties, Sterce is providing one component of sort of a necessary alternative route. They're providing the electoral component. They're providing a mechanism whereby a majority of the population can vote and say, this is where our political loyalties lie now. But that's not the same as if you ask, well, who is it that is actually engaging in building alternative economic activities? We now have health clinics, and they have dismantled. The neoliberals have dismantled the public health service in Greece. And in Greece, when you lose your job for a year, you lose your access to health care benefits. You have half of the Greek population at this point. What's happening is there's self-organization on the part of doctors and nurses, and they're putting together clinics. These clinics are being run as cooperatives, as solidarity type of economy. So there's a tremendous amount of that that's going on at the same time. So I think we're seeing people questioning capitalism in general and increasingly organizing activities on the ground on a very different basis. And then we're also seeing political parties finally rising through the elections saying, well, the neoliberal policies in particular, these are completely unacceptable and intolerable, and we won't go along with them.
I was thinking about the era of neoliberalism has meant a lot of privatization of publicly funded projects that in the past were in public hands. And so naturally, when you see the collapse of areas that were previously so-called communist, there was a massive boom in those economies. It seemed like they were doing so well now that they were going to a capitalist model, because a lot of the things that were held in common were now being privatized and being sold off piece by piece. Can you talk a little bit about the impact that privatization really has as a form of taxation on the people, on society as a whole?
The bailout agreement that was signed by the last government with the Troika, which is that's the European Commission, the IMF, and the European Central Bank. That's the group that came in and said, here, we're going to give you a bailout loan that will prevent you from defaulting on bonds that are owed to wealthy Europeans and that are owned by German and French banks for the most part. They didn't bail out the people of Greece. They bailed out the bondholders and the banks in Northern Europe. So in exchange for that, they said, you're going to have to do a lot of things. You're going to have to lower wage rates. You're going to have to lower the minimum wage. You're going to have to fire tons of people, you know, working in government ministries that are social service ministries. And you are going to have to agree to privatize huge parts of the Greek economy. And Syriza has one of the first things that they said when, one of the first announcements they made was the privatization agreement that the former government had signed on to. They said, we are not going to honor that. We are not going to be privatizing. They are putting together a government employment of last result program that's goal is to have 300,000 new jobs, putting people back to work. And they have said, yes, I mean, in terms of taxes in Greece, so they've said, we are not going to agree to the privatization. And yes, we're going to have tax reform. What had happened previously with the agreements was that the governments had agreed to increase taxes on middle and low-income people, and the governments had not gone through and actually done anything about massive tax fraud and tax avoidance on the part of wealthy Greeks. It is true that Greece is infamous in terms of tax avoidance on the part of their biggest corporations and their oligarchs. And what they did was they said, we're going to increase taxes on regular people, but we're not really going to do anything about the fact that wealthy people aren't paying any taxes. And Syriza turned around and said, we're going to do just the opposite. We are tearing up all those the increases in the VAT taxes that are ordinary people paying. We are canceling those, but we will now actually go through and have a serious tax reform and collect taxes from the wealthy Greeks. You can imagine what kind of resistance this is going to lead to. they're saying you have to cancel huge parts of the debt. We can't, it's simply unpayable. It has to be canceled. So the European banks, European bondholders, they certainly are saying, no, we don't agree with this. We're not going to go along with this. And Syriza is also saying that wealthy Greeks are going to now have to pay their taxes because we're not just going to raise taxes. We're going to cancel those tax increases on poor people.
What's the difference between, you know, taxation that is progressive, regressive, or flat taxes, you know, which is what they're proposing in certain areas like in Calgary? We have no taxes. And so if we bring one, it should be a flat tax, people say. What would that mean? And what are the differences?
Look, the logic of taxes is that there are things called public goods and public services that you simply can't leave to the marketplace for people to buy individually. That nobody is going to individually pay for a public good when other people will be benefiting it from that public good just as much as they will. So that is the essential purpose of taxation in a capitalist economy. Without taxes, there wouldn't be nearly enough public goods. That's common knowledge. That's basic economics 101. And you have to collect taxes to pay for that. Now, having said that, then there's two issues. One is, well, who should you collect the taxes from? If you collect the same percentage of everybody's income in taxes, if you say, okay, everybody's going to pay 20% of their income in taxes, that's how we're going to collect taxes. That's called proportional. That also goes under the name of a flat tax. So proportional or flat tax means everybody pays the same percent. Now, if people who are richer pay a higher percentage of their income in taxes, then the name for that is, oh, that's a progressive tax system. People who are richer, well, first of all, they don't deserve as much of their income as poor people. Ask yourself, a poor person, what percentage of their income did they probably really deserve or earn? Ask yourself the same question for a rich person. What percentage of their income perhaps didn't they really deserve or earn? Well, if your answer is that it's far more likely that a higher percentage of rich people's income isn't really deserved or earned, well, that's the logic for, well, why should they pay a higher percentage of their income? You could also argue they're just able to pay a higher percentage of their income. It's not as big a burden or sacrifice for them. So that's the logic of progressive taxation. Regressive is just the opposite. Regressive says you're actually going to get, poorer you are, the lower your income is, the higher percentage of your income you're going to end up spending in taxes. The taxes that are notoriously regressive are sales taxes. The simple reason for that is rich people save a higher percentage of their income. Sales taxes only tax the part that you consume. So the rich have part of their income they never pay taxes on, a big part, because they save more and they consume less as a percentage of their income, and a poor person consumes practically all of their income, so a sales tax is taxing all of their income. Well, one of the things that the new government in Greece is saying is we're going to get rid of massive tax fraud on the part of the super wealthy, and we are going to increase taxes only in a progressive way, not in a regressive way. We are going to undo the regressive parts of the tax system. There's one other thing people should understand about taxes, and this has to do with, do you raise taxes in a recession? And the answer is you shouldn't, and this is where the austerity debate comes in. What happens in a recession is, well, production's down. Why? Because demand is down. And that's why the businesses aren't producing anything, because they can't sell it. Well, when they don't produce, then there's less income. There's less income for everybody. And when there's less income, the government collects less taxes. So the government tends, in a recession, governments will discover that they start to run budget deficits. And one reaction to that is, oh, when the government runs a budget deficit, they have to reduce their spending. That's what the austerity campaigns have been. That's what the austerity campaigns have been about that have been imposed on the southern economies in Europe. They've said, you're running budget deficits, you have to spend less. But in a recession, when the government spends less, the demand goes down, production goes down, income goes down, and tax revenues go down. So it turns out to actually be counterintuitive and counterproductive. for the government to reduce spending when their big problem is their economy is in the middle of a recession and it's getting worse. So there's also an issue about, well, ordinarily over the long haul, you have to collect enough taxes from somebody to pay for all the public goods that you want. But that doesn't mean that there aren't times when you want to be careful not to raise taxes because it's going to aggravate the recession, and it's also going to actually lower tax revenue collections because income is going to go down.
Your book, Of the People, By the People, makes a case for a participatory economy. And in your book, you showcase the example of Venezuela. And in the midst of a time when oil prices are down, the government is facing serious inflation. And in a recent interview with sociologist Maria Paez, she said, you know, the government refuses to withdraw support for public-funded projects, you know, like health and education. Why is this important as a society and as an economy? Why are those things essential for our a robust return to our economy?
Market economies have a natural tendency to steer people in the direction of more and more private consumption and less public consumption. It's easy to express your demand for private goods, and it's problematic, difficult, and cumbersome for people to express their demand for public goods. So one of the problems with market systems is they have this very, very serious bias against the amount of public goods that are provided compared to private goods. This is environmentally destructive because, on average, private goods are more destructive of the natural environment than public goods are. It also fits in with extreme discrepancies between the very wealthy and everybody else. It's easier to meet the majority's real economic needs through public good provision, and if those needs are not being met, which is what neoliberalism really comes down to, it's basically saying we don't have any intentions anymore of meeting the needs of ordinary people. We're going to prioritize the needs and the consumption of the super wealthy. When you undermine public education, when you undermine public health systems, it's the majority that suffer. The super wealthy go out and buy their own schools and buy their own drugs and buy their own doctors. So that's part of what's going on. And that's part of sort of the tragedy of both market systems in general and the neoliberal version of markets in particular. And I wanted to say one more thing about Syrtse and in particular their new finance minister. If anybody wanted to know, is Syrtse really serious about a change in economic course? Are they really serious about insisting on some things are going to have to change? Or was that all campaign rhetoric, and when the pressure is applied, they're going to cave? One piece of new evidence is the finance minister that the new government has tapped. His name is Yanis Varoufakis, and he's a radical economist like I am. He's somebody we all know, who's been writing about these things for decades, and who is completely and totally committed to challenging and refusing to go along with the neoliberal policy recommendations. He is the one who used the phrase that this austerity campaign that has been imposed on Greece is fiscal waterboarding. That's what he called it, and he is now the finance minister of the new government. He is the worst nightmare for the neoliberals that are running the European Union. This is exactly the person they did not want to have to negotiate with, because he is not going to just roll over and say, oh, okay, well, we wanted you to do this, but now that you've said you won't, we're going to go along with it. People should be aware of that. But the central message that bailing out the banks at the expense of Main Street, no. That's what we campaign against. That's what we will not do. And if you can make people believe that you won't do that, you'll get a lot of support.
Thank you so much for being with us.
Great to be with you. Talk to you again soon.
Talk to you soon. Bye-bye. That was Dr. Robin Hanel. He is the author of the People, By the People, The Case for a Participatory Economy. We have come to the end of our program. Latin Waves is a weekly syndicated program available to campus and community radios. Please visit our website, www.latinwavesmedia.com.